This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Eagles, Falcons, Cardinals, Ravens, Blue Jays, Orioles, Hawks, Thrashers, and even Ducks of the weirdly mighty variety are birds that have inspired nicknames of American pro sports teams. Last February, Only a Game's Michelle Seaton ventured out into the wilds of New England during Super Bowl week and discovered even more birds around which the competition raged.
It's 5:30 a.m. A team of birders stands on a dirt road somewhere outside Essex, Massachusetts. Team Captain Tom Young mimics the distinctive whistle of the screech owl, hoping to hear an answering cry from the nearby pines. There is a tiny yaw on the breeze. Three of the seven team members cock their heads in unison and whisper, great horned.
Did you hear the horned owl?
He just did it again.
Okay.
It's worth 3 points, but only if four of the team members can positively identify it. So they wait and hope the owl comes closer. Although today's 12-hour competition started just 30 minutes ago, time is running short. The team makes a great commotion, hoping to flush out the owls they need so they can move on. This technique is called pishing, and it's one reason this team calls itself the Wicked Pishes. After a minute, it works. This is the third annual Super Bowl of Birding, hosted by the Massachusetts Audubon Society in Newburyport, Massachusetts, a coastal town north of Boston. 26 teams compete to see who can spot the most species and find the rarest birds in the 12 hours allotted. A half dozen teams are made up of hardcore birders like the Wicked Pishes. They all know each other, and they all have a detailed strategy.
We're looking for an eared grebe. The bird's going to be sitting out on the water.
It's the only one in Essex County. That's what's great about it. It's a western bird, so it counts 5 points. Yeah, and a 3-point bonus if we're the first to report it.
We beat another team by 5 minutes to it last year. They may just sort of make it their mission to get there.
Within minutes, they're careening to Niles Beach in Gloucester, half the team in Young's Subaru and half following in a minivan. Suddenly, Young slams on the brakes and points to a long-winged, slate-blue bird flying over the water. Carl Burnswhite calls with a radio to the other car.
That is a great blue heron.
Great blue to our right.
Great blue heron.
Oh, great blue, yeah. Call him quick.
Thank you.
We had it first. Okay. That's what Ian said.
While they drive, Carl muses about the upcoming World Series of Birding, held each May in New Jersey, in which he has competed for the past 10 years. Compared to that 24-hour marathon, today's Super Bowl is a walk in the woods.
That's the real thing. This is fun. Yeah, we've had conversations with other teams here. You've got World Series moves very fast. You've got 24 hours. You've got a whole lot of ground to cover. I mean, people are just as interested in winning. I mean, people who are competitive by nature will compete, you know, with some intensity. And this is a newer contest, too.
Scope call.
Four teams have already set up telescopes at Niles Beach, including a team called the Hits and Misses, arch rivals from last year. Undeterred, the Pishes get out their own telescopes and stake out a spot on the beach. For 3 weeks, birders have visited this beach at dawn to check on the grebe and found it sleeping in the same spot next to its favorite buoy. But today, it's not here. If the grebe is gone, the team cannot waste time here. But if he is sleeping somewhere on the waves, he's worth 8 points to the first team to see him.
I saw a common eider there.
Yes,
While searching for the grebe, the Pishes find several other species, double-check with each other, and mark their sheets. Common eider, black scoter, bufflehead, golden eye. The minutes pass, and it's time to move on. Then team member Jeff Wood thinks he's got the grebe in his scope. They each take a look.
Oh, very good, very good.
It is?
Quick.
It is?
Look quick. As they say, don't belabor the point. You got it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Next four.
The rest of the team members are careful not to betray their excitement. No need to alert the other teams, who may be on the verge of giving up. The second that four of them have seen the grebe, the group quietly packs up its scopes and calls in the sighting to grab the bonus. Then they're off to look for gulls.
No, don't we feel badly for them? You know, we beat them. We scooped them.
We did it, just as we had hoped.
It's 7 a.m., and the team has already identified 30 species and bagged more than 60 points. These aren't beginners. Young has been birding for 22 years. Each team member has logged at least a decade of serious birding, including ornithology courses and competitions like these. Three of them are regulars at the annual World Series of Birding in New Jersey. At the Joppa Flats Educational Center, a regional office of the Mass Audubon Society, Education Coordinator David Larson is updating the bird sightings and plying volunteers with fruit and chocolates to keep them going. Larson answers the phone all day, taking sightings and listening to complaints about rule bending and rudeness. At 5 this morning, some novice birders scared off the American coot, worth 8 points, just as the competition was getting started. There was name-calling afterward.
Some people take things a little bit far. It is true, however, that teams are not supposed to get help from people outside of their team. They're not supposed to have, you know, people calling them up and staking out things. And you're not supposed to talk to other teams about what you've seen and where, because you're not supposed to get outside help.
Larson knows most of the competitors, and the complaints don't surprise him much. Although he respects the wicked pishes, he isn't holding out great hope for them to win today.
Certainly, I know that the competition is wicked tough up in Rockingham County. There's like four teams that are full of really, really good birders up there. So we'll see what happens with that one.
In fact, the wicked pishes will win, finishing the day with 86 species sightings and 196 points. The win gives each team member bragging rights for the year, along with a $100 gift certificate to a nearby birdwatcher's supply store. But the win is hours from now. At this moment, the excitement is centered on a thicket in which a sharp-shinned hawk may be lurking. 3 points. If only it would move. For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton, somewhere in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
What's that chipping?
Oh, what's that?
That's an interesting chip.
Yeah. It's...
Roger Clemens returned to the Houston Astros in June after also being courted by the Texas Rangers, New York Yankees, and Boston Red Sox. But before the Rocket accepted a $12 million prorated deal from his once-and-future team, there was a fifth team in the mix, the Brockton Rocks of the independent Can-Am League. Back in May, I talked with Brockton Rocks team president Jim Lucas, and I asked him what the team was offering the man whom some feel is the best pitcher of all time.
Well, Bill, money really is no object. We're going to give him the maximum monthly salary allowed by the league, and that is going to be $3,000 a month. We're going to have to prorate May because we don't open up till May 25th, so we'll prorate that figure. But for June, July, August, and 4 days in September, $3,000 a month.
It's sounding a little like that Saturday Night Live sketch where Lorne Michaels had a check for $1,000 and all the Beatles had to do was show up and claim it.
Maybe there's a tie-in because Lorne Michaels is a minority owner of The Rock.
Why am I not surprised?
But I'll tell you, Bill, I mean, here's the thing. Somebody with Clemens's numbers, I mean, clearly a future Hall of Famer, deserves an opening day start.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the teams going after him, we're legitimately the only team that can offer him that opening day start on May 25th.
An excellent point. And I understand if the money and the opportunity to start on opening day aren't enough, there are other incentives and benefits that you're offering.
Well, there are. I mean, here's another thing. We have a wonderful relationship with the residents in here in Brockton. And if Roger's family comes to town to see him pitch, we can get him a pretty good rate of about $84 a night over there for the family. That's very good. And then the Brockton High School parking lot, it might be, a quarter mile from the stadium. He can park his car there. We will assign an intern to carry his bags back and forth. And then, you know, in the locker room, he can pick any uniform number he wants. Now, granted, the numbers 21 and 22 are already gone, so he's going to have to pick a different number. But, you know, any other number can be his.
Any other number. And maybe whoever has 21 or 22 would be willing to negotiate. That often happens at the major league level.
And I believe at this level, a player holding 21 or 22 would be wide open to that negotiation.
Yeah, $10 or $12 would probably get Roger the number of his choice.
That's meal money. A couple other things, Bill. We are willing to give up the corner locker in our locker room. He'll have his own rocking chair, and we'll have Roger printed on it, and it'll be on duct tape in case he moves on. And, you know, a couple other quick points. He's never pitched a no-hitter, and the odds of him pitching a no-hitter in this league would be pretty good. And then, you know, another thing is, if he needs Red Sox tickets, we know people.
Now, frankly, I find this utterly overwhelming. Has Roger replied, or have his people gotten back to you?
We have been in contact with Randy and Alan Hendricks and are awaiting word. I mean, I was actually stunned when I saw that nationally the press reported there are four suitors for Roger, and I assumed that we would be one of them. And then to see that the Texas Rangers were the fourth, so we're going to reestablish contact with his agents just to make sure they're aware. You know, the Astros can come up with 10 reasons why they think Clemens should sign with them, but I got to tell you, our reasons make a lot of sense, and he should give this serious consideration.
Somehow, last June, the Astros' $12 million proximity to Clemens' home and the chance to return to the World Series won out over Lucas's munificent offer. And now, after the Red Sox' disastrous fall from playoff contention, you can still hear the locals wondering, what if, oh, what if? You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, soccer migrates to Michigan. But first, have you had your fill of competitions involving activities that aren't normally considered sports? Well, if so, the following report by Gabe O'Connor on a competitive eating tournament in November of 2005 might cause your gorge to rise. But listen on, if you can stomach it.
Come on, put your hands in the air, put your hands in the air. Keep them there, keep them there. Put your hands in the air.
Eric Badlands Booker is not the first athlete to put out a rap album, but he's probably the only MC that can eat 4 pounds of corned beef hash in less than 2 minutes. The 420-pound Booker has two albums, Hungry and Focused and Hungry and Focused 2, The Ingestion Engine. Both albums are mostly about his sport, competitive eating, which makes sense. After all, this isn't a concert, it's merely a warm-up to the 2005 Verizon Voice Wing Battle. Today's event is further proof that competitive eating has moved beyond the realm of the County Fair Apple Pie Chowdown. Competitions are run by the International Federation of Competitive Eating. The crown jewel of the IFOCE circuit is the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Championship on Coney Island. That's been an annual 4th of July event on ESPN for years. Corporate sponsors are now bankrolling contests that can earn winners thousands of dollars. It's not enough for most to live on, but it's certainly enough to keep competitors like Booker on the circuit.
I mean, when I first started, I just did Nathan's. It got my, you know, got my year supply of hot dogs and my trophy. Look forward to the next year's contest. Now I'm doing a contest, at least two contests a month. All right, various foods.
There's a new generation of gurgitators stepping up the level of competition. Joey Chestnut is a 21-year-old from San Jose, California, and a rookie on the IFOCE circuit. Chestnut looks like the kid next door, with a buzz cut and a low-key attitude. When you meet him, you'd have no clue he's the number 3 ranked eater in the world. Chestnut recently won the World Grilled Cheese title by consuming 32 and a half sandwiches in 10 minutes. Chestnut says he prepares to engorge mass quantities of food by drinking gallons of water at a time.
If I'm going to get on stage, I might as well try to win. And what it takes to win is a little bit of training, and that's what I got to do.
Edward Cookie Jarvis, a veteran on the circuit, claims he was one of the inventors of water training.
That was my first training regimen. Yeah. I used to do, the first time I drank a gallon of water, it took me like 3 minutes. I have it down to a minute flat. 59 seconds is the best time I've ever done for a gallon. I've drinking 2 gallons in 2 minutes or 25 seconds. That's 17 pounds of water. It's gaining birth.
Jarvis, a married father of two, is a Long Island realtor. On game day, the 400-pound cookie arrives with an American flag do-rag and a jacket covered with patches commemorating his more than 30 titles. On the back is an airbrushed picture of himself called Mini Cookie. Jarvis says family demands will soon force him to retire from eating, at least competitively, but there are plenty of characters here today that hope to take his place. There's Jason Erb, the herbivore. Humble Bob Shout, the vegetarian who only eats meat during competitions. The contestant in wrestling-style face paint who goes by the name of Eater X. And the man who perhaps is the biggest name in competitive eating.
A guy can bring worlds together, and when you bring worlds together, planets collide, and I want a big, rousing hometown welcome for this man, Crazy Legs Compton!
Crazy Legs Conti may be number 18 in the IFOC rankings, but he's the sport's number one ambassador. At the opening of a documentary based on his eating exploits, Conti ate his way out of a popcorn sarcophagus, which earned him the nickname the Houdini of Cuisine. For those who claim competitive eating has turned into something like professional wrestling, with a lot more food, Conti has an answer.
Competitive eating, these are just guys and women who have loved food, who want to become gustatory gladiators. They just happen to be eccentric. Everything you see here is legitimate. There's no faking eating 5 pounds of chicken wing meat in 10 minutes.
That's an exploit to which there is a method. Conti says he's perfected a technique he calls the meat umbrella.
The drumsticks, you spin it, basically, in your mouth. The paddles pose difficulty for a lot of eaters. I take the hinge with my forefingers and I push the meat down as I'm chewing a drumstick so that the meat basically pops at the bottom of the wing as sort of an umbrella, and I can just flip that up into my mouth and the bone never comes into play.
She ate 46 dozen Louisiana oysters in 10 minutes. She is the top-ranked eater in the United States of America. She is here for the Rise and Voice Wing Battle at King's. Ladies and gentlemen, bring her out, Sonia Thomas!
Whatever method Sonia Thomas employs, it usually works. She's the number two eater in the world, although at 100 pounds, no one's figured out where she puts it all. Her nickname, the Black Widow, says being the smallest competitor and one of the few women on the circuit isn't a problem.
Look at that. All the eating contestants were all male, right? So I'm the female. The Black Widow is a female spider, right? Spider kill the male spider and eat them, right? So when I come against the men, and I beat them and I kill them and win.
And most expect Thomas to do just that today. The only eater ranked higher than the Black Widow is 5-time Nathan's champion, Takeru Kobayashi. But he's in Japan, so the Black Widow has a clear opportunity as the contest begins.
From 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
For 12 minutes, the dozen or so contestants line a long table and gorge while onlookers cheer. Thomas and Chestnut are plowing through 3-pound trays of wing meat at an alarming rate. By the 6-minute mark, Badland Booker's shirt is covered in wing sauce. Crazy Legs Conti has abandoned the meat umbrella method in favor of the shove as much chicken in your mouth as you can technique. By the 9-minute mark, the pace has definitely slowed. Conti has so much food in his mouth, it's not clear what he'll stop doing first, chew or breathe. Meanwhile, the Black Widow and Chestnut seem to be running neck and neck, right until the end.
4, 3, 2, stop eating, ladies and gentlemen! Give us an applause!
Now, with the wing battle over, the contestants line up with their trays of wing carcasses and head to the scales for the weigh-in. Some are still chewing or forcing down what's left in their mouths with whatever fluid they can find.
3.2.
Finally, the judges determine the winner, and it's an upset.
And in first place, with 4.2 pounds of whippy off the bone, ladies and gentlemen, Joey Chessman from
Shockingly, the Black Widow has finished fourth. A visibly upset Thomas quietly leaves the club as Joey Chestnut collects his oversized check for $3,500. After his victory, a confident Chestnut says his next goal is to defeat Kobayashi. Crazy Legs Conti has an even loftier goal for his sport.
Certainly, people no longer need to ask, is this a sport? That's been answered. The question is, where is the sport going? And I think you're going to see TV shows, movies, oversized trading cards. And finally, I think it'll be in the Olympics. Every athlete who wins a gold medal is using food for fuel. Why not make the food the event?
On November 19th at the Crystal Hamburger Championship in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Joey Chestnut almost pulled off the unthinkable. Kobayashi, whose only loss on American soil was to a Kodiak bear, mounted a furious comeback to edge Chestnut in the final minute. Maybe Kobayashi can be beaten after all. For only a game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
I like food, food ain't good. I like food, food ain't good. Give me burgers, give me fights. Really, they just love inside. You make good with type of soup. Get my way or all they do. I like food, food ain't good. I like food, food ain't good. Curses, I'm back and eating. I like food, food ain't good. I like food, food ain't good.
As players and fans from around the world converged on Germany for the 2006 World Cup, reporter Adam Allington met with players and fans who traveled the Americas looking for agricultural work. He found that though these disparate groups share a common passion for soccer, they didn't enjoy the same degree of welcome.
Noch 2 Minuten in diesem Endspiel. Rivaldo! Was für ein Tor! 1,5 Minuten vor dem Ende macht das 3-2. Sein drittes Tor an diesem Abend. Und ich halte jetzt meinen Mund.
Few sports feed national pride more than World Cup soccer.
Mexico! Mexico! Mexico!
You're a big Mexico fan, huh? Why Mexico?
Because me and him are cousins. We're all cousins and we're from Mexico.
The fact that these 5- and 6-year-old kids even know about the World Cup says something about the role of soccer in their lives. But they're not watching Mexico versus Paraguay. They're watching family and friends compete in Michigan's only Hispanic soccer league. Each week, roughly 150 players and fans make the trip to Traverse City for a day of soccer. Mexican style. Fans cheer their team from bleachers or beach chairs. The sound of Tejano music blasts out of pickup trucks. People sell tacos, tamales, and soda off of their tailgates. While the atmosphere is considerably more relaxed than a typical World Cup match, many fans carry a different kind of loyalty.
The wives, they got really, really upset if somebody touched the husband, and they scream. They don't care. They scream. They lose control, and sometimes they say a lot of things, you know, that can offend you even to the referee.
Miguel Osorio owns a Mexican grocery store in Traverse City. He got the idea to form a migrant soccer league in 2002.
Because they're coming from big cities, and they said, why you don't organize any football tournament or something? And I said, are you really, how many players do you have? He said, I have the whole team. And, you know, people from Santa's Bay, the ones that work on those fields, in Cadillac, in Lake City, in all that area. And I said, okay, put a team together, and I challenge you with my team. I will put some people together from Traverse City.
Approximately 15,000 Mexican farm workers work in northwest Michigan, harvesting mostly cherries and apples. There are 6 teams in the soccer league. After cherry season, that number could climb up to 8. Johnny Calderon plays on one of those teams, named after a hallowed English Premier League club.
One of our favorite teams is the Arsenal team from England, so we just come here and have fun. I mean, it's pretty competitive for being, you know, adult men that work, you know, overtime during the week and just come here and have fun on their day off. Most of these guys are pretty much working 50 or 60 hours a week. So, I mean, that pretty much tells you, you know, passion about the sport.
But the soccer league is not for Hispanics only. David Johnson is one of a handful of Anglos who also play. He says that short of actually going to Mexico, he would never have the chance to experience this much Mexican culture.
It's really true. Like, when I'm out there and they're speaking Spanish, I feel like I could say that I went to Mexico today just by the words I'm hearing. And compared to playing with, like, other Americans, these guys kick butt.
Large gatherings like the soccer league are rare in northern Michigan. For one, people work a lot, sometimes 7 days a week during harvest. Another reason is because some of the players are undocumented. Border patrol cars are sometimes seen parked outside of grocery stores, churches, and movie theaters. Jessica Gonzalez and her friend are selling tamales. They say people are often too scared to come out.
They don't get together because when you have a large group of Mexicans together, then the cops catch them and then they go to jail. And they get, what's that one word they go back to Mexico?
Deported?
Yeah, that word.
They get deported.
Despite the risk of deportation, people still show up every Sunday to watch and play soccer. And judging from all the smiles and cheers, most wouldn't miss it. Again, Miguel Osorio.
The Spanish people who come and work on the farms, thanks to them, we have nice, delicious cherries or wines on our table. I think it's hard work, but we love to do that. And so I think we deserve some respect. And looks like we're getting more support every year. So here in Traverse City, now then when we're together and we found a good amount of people who likes to do sports, and when we're there on the fields, it reminds us like when we were little in Mexico.
For Only a Game, I'm Adam Allington in Michigan.
If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to my weekly commentary, or to longer versions of my conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. You're listening to Only a Game. The Bears could hibernate. The Eagles might all fly the coop. The White Sox could all find themselves arrested in the loop. In Boston, maybe they've begun to tear down Fenway Park. Perhaps this week has featured wizard chess played in the dark. The NHL may be on strike, and maybe yesterday, a woman who plays basketball signed with the NBA. My point is that no matter what's gone on across the nation in sports, we just don't care because we've all gone on vacation. At Alabama, Oklahoma, Florida, who knows upon each campus where the love of football grows and grows beyond the reach of logic. Maybe this week was the one when all the players were surprised to find they had a ton of academic work to do and so they couldn't play. You might look in the library to find them all today. This may have been the week when Monday night was Monday night and not a glowing eve of worship, noted for the sight of men tuned into football with their snack bowls at their sides. Perhaps instead this week those men were all out with their brides at movies or museums or at late romantic dinners, and everyone involved would feel at evening's end like winners. Perchance this week the baseball players' union has announced, no matter which teams won and which teams got completely trounced, that all the players have enough. They don't need any more, and all the money that they have and some they've made before will go to pay the teachers and the social workers who should all be paid much more for all the good work that they do. If all these things have happened and we missed the stories, well, perhaps I should apologize, but you can probably tell that I am just as happy sports is going on apace and we're not here because we're occupying other space away from where we monitor the progress of the games and who has won and lost and which bad calls the mad coach blames. Perhaps we're on a beach or on a mountaintop alone, beyond the reach of even the most powerful cell phone. In any case, we're not around to chronicle the glory of this week's most superbly grand or weirdly goofy story arising from the athletes and the games the athletes play. We'll all be back next week for that, but we ain't here today. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, some very old friends gather in Hawaii to keep the canoes afloat and the traditions alive. But first, who could have guessed in 1994 that the drama surrounding the Tanya Nancy fiasco would lend itself to, well, drama.
The difference is you have to have the balls to punch the other girl in the face.
Late on a Monday afternoon in early May, the theater space at Zero Arrow Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts is dark and a little stuffy. Powdered and rouged, clad in a bright red and sequined figure skating costume and wearing bright red boxing gloves, soprano Kristen Sargent prepares for the dress rehearsal in which she will create the role of Tanya Harding in Tanya and Nancy the Opera. It is an opportunity she could not previously have anticipated.
I never imagined I would get to tumble on the ground and throw punches and sing operatically all at the same time.
Tanya's rolling around and punch throwing notwithstanding, Abigail Aldori, the composer of the music for the opera based on the linked misadventures of former figure skaters Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, insists that the production is not intended to demean anybody.
I really want to stress that this is not a parody and we're not poking fun at people. Obviously, it's a funny opera because it was absurd what happened. And also that sort of goes with my composing style naturally. There's always a little bit of humor in it.
Not perhaps at the time. The real-life drama represented in the opera included not only Tanya's broken skate lace at the 94 Olympics and tears, and Nancy Kerrigan's silver medal performance and tears, but an assault on Kerrigan by Shane Stant, an associate of Tanya Harding and her husband, Jeff Gillooly. That's a circumstance that Abigail Aldori says is front and center in her production.
We've got our opening scene with the first press conferences since the knee whacking. Tanya and Nancy meet for the first time. Then we go into a flashback, which shows the knee whacking.
Knee whacking as opera.
Yeah.
This is irresistible.
It's incredible to me. I mean, I wrote it, and every time I watch it...
Oh, 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 I whack your knee. Something like that?
Not exactly.
Shane weighs 300 pounds. Shane says he went to spy school.
Abigail Aldori's accomplice in Tanya and Nancy the Opera is her aunt, Elizabeth Searle. Needing a subject for the musical composition she had to write for the master's thesis she was completing at Tufts University Music Department, Aldori sought the advice of Searle, who'd written several books. As far as Searle was concerned, there was no question about what the subject of her niece's opera should be.
That was just literally the first thing that came to my mind is, we're going to do Tanya and Nancy. And I told that to Abigail. We both just laughed. And it just struck me, to me, it was a perfect fit. Like, we could do a darkly comic opera. Because I feel like Abigail and I have a certain sensibility we share that I would call kind of dark yet perky. Like
dark yet perky?
Yes, that's my. I've settled on that as a way to describe it. I feel like
sounds like a kind of Tanya and Nancy mind meld going on.
Yeah. Well, there could be some element of that, yeah.
Galooney! 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 Galooney!
Searle and Aldori say that 80% of the words in Tanya and Nancy were taken from newspaper accounts. That would explain why a chorus of reporters occasionally chants something like, Gillooly, colluded. But one of the more striking moments comes in a portion of the libretto that doesn't sound as if it was ripped from the headlines. Sure, Nancy actually said, my mother is legally blind, but does anybody remember Tanya responding with, my mother is legally nuts? I asked Kristen Sargent, who plays Tanya, if she felt the real Tanya would be angry at that particular departure from the record.
I hope she wouldn't be offended because I know she's a better boxer than I am. However, I think that it's we take such a meta sort of... I think of these two figures as being sort of Olympian in this opera. I mean, we've taken... It's opera. It's not even a play. It's not musical theater. We've heightened it to such an extreme that I think Tanya or Nancy watching it would understand that incorporating the way the media perceives the two characters and then also the broadness of the strokes in terms of what they've actually said wouldn't be too close to home. Although there is a lot of domestic reality for Tanya, including, you know, the abusive relationship between her and Galuli and her mother, that probably would make it something that she might stay home for.
I said to you, come on, it's better than playing the lottery. And Tanya, my wife, she finally says to me, yes, you said yes. Come on, Tanya, confess.
According to composer Abigail Aldori, word is that Nancy Kerrigan, too, has found a reason to stay away from the show.
She hasn't commented directly about the opera, but recently she was asked if she was coming to the opera, and she said, oh no, I already know how it ends.
Though the master's thesis of somebody studying music in graduate school would not normally attract much attention from the critics, Tanya and Nancy, the opera, has been the exception. Ever since the librettist leaked word of the project to a friend who knew somebody who worked for Associated Press, Aldori has been fielding inquiries.
It was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. For one thing, the music wasn't even, it was barely started when they got a hold of the story, and it went on the AP, and I'd never experienced anything like it.
Aldori says the publicity was in part a blessing, since it did push her to finish the work, but when the people generating that publicity and the folks responding to it found out how a theater piece that's a master's thesis works, they might have been a little disappointed. Tanya and Nancy, the opera, was scheduled for exactly two performances, both of which occurred on Tuesday, May 2nd. The composer spoke laughingly of opportunities off-Broadway someday, but at this point, those deals may be almost as iffy as a triple Lutz on a broken lace.
He gave me a good whack.
A good whack. He gave her a good whack. Good whack. Good whack. A good whack. He gave her a good whack. Good whack. Good whack.
It was a hard, hard stick.
The term tradition, as it applies to sport, might lead one to think New York Yankees, Green Bay Packers, Boston Celtics, or Montreal Canadiens. But this year, reporter Jesse Hardman attended a festival in Hawaii where the participants revived a cherished tradition that predates the aforementioned North American pro sports by many hundreds of years.
At the foot of the ocean on Maui's west side, Lahaina Town, old friends are gathering for a special ceremony. A long line of Polynesians are entering Kamehameha Iki Park, a hallowed place for Hawaiian natives. Hawaiian chief Keomoko Kapo is dressed in a yellow loincloth decorated with symbols like sea urchins and shells. Kapo gives each visitor a traditional greeting, which consists of touching nose to nose and gazing directly into the eyes of each guest. If it weren't for some tennis courts and a surf school in the background, it would be easy to imagine oneself in Hawaii's ancient kingdom. At least that's how Kapo sees it.
We try to make sure that we honor
our families that come from afar, we haven't rekindled the fires for a long time. So every time we are confronted with each other, it's the mingling of minds within the spirit. It's like playing chess with words, sort of like, where have you been for the past 500 years?
Maui has hosted Polynesian canoe craftsmen and women for the past 9 years as part of the International Festival of Canoes. The goal of the event, says Keumoko Kapo, is to remind the world that native Pacific art and culture is alive and well. The festival visitors are the remaining keepers of a craft, canoe carving, that is central to Polynesian history and a way of life. And Kapo says it's more than just a craft. It's a powerful source of identity.
If you know your genealogy, you need to know three things. The name of your mountain, the name of your river, and the name of your canoe. Once you know those three things, then you know who you are. When these carvers come here and they carve their va'a, their canoe from their place, they're automatically saying, this is who we are.
At this year's festival, Kapo leads a group of 20 Hawaiians in a traditional welcoming ceremony. A group of 50 or so participants from New Zealand, Tahiti, the Cook Islands, Hawaii, and Tonga look on. But as soon as the opening formalities are over, it's time to work. Logs of albizia wood from Hawaii's Big Island are laid out for each team of carvers. The longest, nearly 50 feet, is for a fishing canoe, or waka, as a group of Maori craftsmen from New Zealand call it. The leader of the Maori team is 78-year-old Hector Busby. Busby wipes the sweat from his forehead and sizes up his log. Widely considered the dean of the canoe carving fraternity, Busby is known for his ability to see beauty and functionality in a massive, gnarled piece of wood.
The log, the way it was laying, it looked okay, but after I had another look at it, 4 foot from the top end of the tree, there was a kink. So I decided to roll it over and have that kink coming upwards for the bow.
From sunup to sundown, carvers and their teams saw, hack, and shape their logs using a variety of techniques. Some crews brandish tape measures and other conventional tools. Others conjure a canoe with little more than imagination and chainsaws.
I already saw the canoe the first time I saw the log.
Stephen Feo Feoko leads a team of carvers from the Kingdom of Tonga. The popa, the Tongan word for canoe, is linked to that island's distinction as one of the only countries on Earth not colonized by Europeans. Feo Feoko says popas are no longer made for war, but he says they continue to be used for transportation, fishing, and as a symbol of Tongan community.
You don't really have a home without a canoe. A canoe is like part of the family. So the main hull is representing the father, and the outrigger is the mother. Being joined and connected by the crossbar, which is the kiato. And the kiato is to symbolize the children, the link of the family.
After a week of heavy labor, the canoe hulls are moved down Lahaina's front street to an enormous banyan tree at the center of town. The new venue provides shade for the second phase, sanding, carving, and finishing. The crews work inside areas cordoned off with yellow caution tape as tourists look on, giving the scene the appearance of a living museum. Michael Tavioni, an artist and carver from the Cook Islands, says the public exposure is good, but only if people are educated in the process.
Well, if you happen to walk by and look, I hope you remember that there is a culture intact. Because otherwise, we're just monkeys on show with a yellow tag put around us. And people come and look at us as if we are in a circus or something.
Tavioni points out that most of the fully functional canoes constructed during the festival end up on display in the hotels and restaurants of the event's corporate sponsors. A walk around town shows canoes in various states of disrepair. Tavioni says that's a shame.
The canoe will die without having a sea life.
Students from nearby Lahaina Luna High School are building a full-on outrigger sailing canoe. 15-year-old Ika Palawatan wipes sawdust from her brow as she takes a break from sanding.
It's a lot of pride and honor to get back into the cultural history of the Hawaiian people, and to be a high school student and to be among all these master carvers is an amazing feeling. When we're eating dinner, eating lunch, they come up to us and ask us about how our canoe is going, and we kind of get off into the subject of how they live and their island and what it's like to be them.
Palawatan says she hopes to get more of her cohorts into carving and to get this new canoe out on the water as much as possible. At the annual Parade of the Canoes, middle schoolers from local Maui Prep Academy wave and toss flowers from the hull of the boat made by the festival's Maori visitors. Master carver Hector Busby's canoe is 48 feet long and gleaming red, with an elaborately carved stern, bow, and gunwales. Per tradition, all the finished canoes are paraded through the streets of Lahaina before they make their maiden voyage. Maui Prep will inherit the Maori's boat. Faculty say they plan to make it the school's largest teaching tool. This makes Master Maori carver Hector Busby extremely happy.
Now the kids is going to paddle it, and that's what I like about it. That it's not going to sit, you know, it's going to be used.
After the ceremonial cutting of the umbilical cord, a leafy rope symbolically connecting the canoe to the ground, the carvers lift their vessels and push them bow first into the ocean. As they paddle, the former trees are finally transformed into canoes, perpetuating the Polynesian belief that nothing truly dies, especially tradition. For Only a Game, I'm Jesse Hardman in Lahaina, Hawaii.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to peruse our panoply of podcasts, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Kristen Sargent, the operatic voice of Tanya Harding.
The difference is you have to have the balls to punch the other girl in the face.
It's Robert Frost, isn't it? Over there where the road forks, I punched the other girl in the face, and that has made all the difference. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is